I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. Considering the ruin of Syria as a test of the new American restraint, as it's called in foreign policy, with Iraq and Afghanistan bleeding in our rearview mirror, is there a case still to be made for American intervention with anything more than words in Syria's miserable meltdown? Our guest, Steve Walt from Harvard, a columnist for the foreign policy website, was a leader of the realist school of American strategy before it was fashionable. He warned all along that the war with Iraq would undermine the U.S. interest. Today, he's saying that we should be fighting the temptation to commit American power in Syria. Our guest from London, Mohammed Idris Ahmad, is the historian of that folly in Iraq, the neoconservative war, he calls it in a new book. But he's writing now that he'll tell us that Syria is different, a murderous tyranny that only the threat of American force can check. The news and pictures from Syria are perfectly awful. Sarin gas against civilians succeeded by barrel bombs on Aleppo. Millions of Syrians on the run. All varieties of torture. Targeting of children and doctors. A death toll in 2.5 years of warfare, approaching now 150,000 people, and no end in sight. We asked a Boston doctor, Larry Ronan, a veteran of humanitarian disasters in Iraq and Haiti, to give us a picture of what he's been seeing in his work with Syrian refugees in Jordan.
In Syria, the numbers that we're talking about are huge, who are being affected. There are at least 6.5 million people who are displaced internally in the country, and almost half of those are children.
In a population of 23 million.
And then 2.4 million people who are now in neighboring countries, the neighboring countries being Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and Iraq. You know, in Syria, there's sort of a systematic and deliberate attack on civilians and medical professionals.
Strange, isn't it, that we can see so much of this conflict on YouTube and otherwise and feel so helpless?
Yes, technologically, we are close to the conflict, but in the sense that we can see it, it's well reported. On the other hand, it's far from us, I think, for a number of reasons. The Arab world is one we're pulling away from, at least in the United States and maybe Britain as well, in the sense that we've been in Iraq and we're tired of that war. And the culture and the language, it makes it less accessible in other ways.
Larry Ronan, imagine you took 100 of your best friends from Boston to the border.
Mm-hmm.
What would they vote to do?
A sane man or woman would vote to have some sort of intervention to take two fighting sides and stop them from fighting. That's very naive. That can't be done. You'd see families fleeing, and as they flee, they'd be sniped at. Some would not make it across the border. They get across the border. They have nowhere to go. It'll be cold. It's wintertime there as it's wintertime here. And they'll be without shelter. They'll be without food or any resources, and they'll be lost. So, and that's millions and millions of people. One thing people should realize about this conflict is most of the refugees are being absorbed into the communities of these countries. They're not going into camps. So the image that we have of refugee camps, that's not how people are being taken care of. They're being absorbed in little villages and cities and stressing these other countries a great deal.
Last word, what do your friends and neighbors in Boston need to know about Syria?
They need to know it's the biggest human rights catastrophe, at least in my generation, and that they should pay much attention to it, give resources when they can to assist civilians and families in Syria.
Larry Ronan, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Dr. Larry Ronan runs the Thomas Durant Fellowship for Refugee Medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Steve Walt, remind us why so many Americans felt relieved and happy when President Obama decided last Labor Day, 6 months ago, not to intervene in Syria.
Well, I'm not sure many Americans were happy about it, because you can't look at what's happening in Syria and not want to do something. But I think most Americans believed that he made the right call back in August not to intervene with military force for a couple of reasons. The main one being that military force was not going to solve the problem here. That if we pour armaments into Syria, we will cause more people to die because it'll just exacerbate the civil war. Russia will up the ante. Iran will up the ante. Hezbollah will up the ante. So more Syrians will suffer if we increase our presence. Moreover, we have no military options that we would be willing to undertake that are going to end the civil war here. The only way you could stop the fighting now is to have a massive ground force intervention. You'd have to send foreign troops in well-armed foreign troops in very large numbers to separate the warring parties and make it simply impossible for them to fight. There is no public support for that in any external power, and certainly not here in the United States. So people who want us to intervene, and the option the president was considering last summer was some sort of air power, cruise missiles, airstrikes of some kind. And the problem there is that airstrikes are not going to alter the Assad regime's brutal policies. Airstrikes are not going to be able to end that civil war. You ought to remember the fact that the United States bombed Vietnam massively, and that didn't win that war. We bombed Germany massively in World War II, but we had to invade the country to stop Hitler at the end of the day. So air power is actually of pretty limited utility. And I think what the president realized back last August was, first of all, there was not much public support for even starting down this road. And second of all, the options he had available to him would not end the suffering.
This feels different in lots of ways. And let me just say, I won't say I was happy at Obama's decision on Labor Day. I was relieved. I felt we had broken a bad habit of almost an addiction to American interventions. But this one is different. We are seeing so much more of the horror close up on video in awful color. I wonder sometimes if realism is enough. What do we need in the way, I won't say moral gestures, but some sort of identification with that much suffering?
Well, again, we do identify with what's happening and why it's awful.
Well, I wonder if we call off the, you know,
well,
the
again, there is no situation so horrific that you couldn't possibly make it worse. Right. And so one possibility here is we do intervene and we eventually, through a grinding process, bring down the Assad government. And then you have a whole series of contending militias and warlords, some of them who have been armed by some of our allies. And we have essentially a replay of Libya, but on a much larger scale. You'll recall that the United States decided, against some objections of people in the Obama administration, to intervene in Libya. And it was going to be just fine once we got rid of a horrific leader, Muammar Gaddafi. We did, in fact, help the rebels get rid of Muammar Gaddafi. And what we have now in Libya is anarchy. And I think the anarchy could be substantially worse in the Syrian case, given the desire for revenge that's going to be widely held there. The fact that there is a large set of rebel groups now, and some of those rebel groups are either allied with al-Qaeda or, in the case of the Islamics, a rebel group that calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, they're a group that are so extreme that al-Qaeda has even repudiated them. Right. So the idea, again, that we can come in a precise, sanitary fashion, eliminate a few bad guys and solve this problem, cause the war to stop, I think was naive. I think the president recognized that. And it's nothing that should make any of us happy. But again, our military intervention here would make this situation worse.
There are ambiguities and contradictions here. I mean, President Obama did say Assad must go. He also said in August, when he was planning to go in, this is not regime change. We're simply firing a big shot across his bow and warning him that we're watching closely. Why isn't that still, a manageable signal?
Well, this, I think, is the position that at least some in the administration have begun to take, and you've even seen some other former American officials take this position, that Assad will probably not be able to regain control over the entire country, but the rebels will probably be unable to drive him from power anytime soon. We may end up with a sort of stalemated situation, and it's a situation like that where we may, in fact, be able to then allow diplomacy to work and get some kind of agreement which ends the suffering. I would add just one other point here. This does not mean that the United States should do nothing here. I think the United States and its allies could be doing much more in the form of humanitarian assistance, particularly to the refugees who have gotten out of the country and are now living, as the previous report indicated, in various neighboring countries. That would obviously be very good for them. That would also be very good for the neighboring countries, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, who are having to bear this particular burden. Moving humanitarian aid is something we're very good at doing. That's a logistical problem. That doesn't involve trying to socially engineer Syrian society from outside. And I think we ought to be doing much more of that.
Steve, what does a realist make of, seems to me, a kind of unspoken consensus that Syria as a nation is over, a kind of made-up nation after World War One, but that it's now kind of consuming itself, as you say, dividing and decentralizing, that we could have five Syrias, five little nations, or seven, or 14. What does a realist make of the breaking up of what has been, for better and worse, a kind of keystone of an arch in the Middle East?
Well, I think realism or just common sense tells you that this is worrisome. The only thing worse than a brutal dictatorship is anarchy, particularly in areas where there are deep ethnic, religious, or other cleavages within a society, a desire for revenge for past sins and things like that. And if you think about the sort of post-World War I political settlement in the Middle East, which created these rather artificial mm-hmm. countries, Jordan and Syria and Iraq in particular, you do have to wonder whether we are starting to see that set of arrangements that emerged in 1919 start to unravel. And I think that process is not going to be a pretty one if it continues. The only caution, again, that a realist would take to this is that we're not in a very good position to try and negotiate a solution to that. Certainly, we're not going to be able to come in and draw a new set of lines and try to impose them. This is going to ultimately have to be worked out by the peoples in the region. It got screwed up in 1919 because outsiders came in and tried to draw a bunch of lines. And if there's going to be a lot of bloodletting going on there and sorting this out in the future, we want to keep our distance from it.
Mohammed Idris Ahmad joins us from just outside London. Pakistani by birth, trained in Scotland as a political analyst, now a teacher in England. His new book from Edinburgh University Press is titled The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. Idris edits and writes on the website Pulse. You told me, Idris, that you wanted to turn Steve Walt's thinking around. Here's your shot.
Well, I'll begin by saying that although I've never met Steve, I consider myself a student because his writings have been part of my education, and his blog is one of my daily reads. But I think on Syria, Steve has some assumptions which I think are flawed. And to begin with, I would question the description of the conflict in Syria as a civil war. I think what's happening in Syria is a case of state repression because all the air power, armor, artillery, and unconventional weapons, they're all on one side. So this is not an equal fight. And so what the label civil war does is it sort of creates this impression of a parity between the two sides, and which distorts the debate. And regarding the question of intervention, now obviously I also don't believe that military solutions, that there are political questions can be resolved militarily, but military can aid the resolution of political disputes. Here, what has started, what in fact remains, a struggle for self-determination. And obviously what has happened since then is because of the inaction of the rest of the world and the indifference, inside the opposition has fragmented, various outside actors have tried to create their own local, they've tried to support local groups according to their own agendas. But ultimately, the struggle remains an indigenous one. So for that,
Idris, I want you to get to the kind of intervention you would approve, you think could be effective.
Well, I think, Steve mentioned that air power will not be successful. I don't think that that is the case. Air power is, of course, going to have an effect because right now, most of the people who are being killed in Syria are from barrel bombs and from the cluster munitions and from fuel air explosives. So even if we have some kind of a deterrent in the air, even if we have a no-fly zone, so which means that Assad's air force, which is no match for any Western air force, so these planes will not be getting off the ground if they have the threat. Right now, they're able to bomb with complete impunity, and they're bombing completely indiscriminately. So there needs to be some kind of a deterrent. And the no-fly zones have been successful in northern Iraq for nearly 12 years. The Kurdish regions were protected from any kind of Iraqi retaliation. So something like that could be implemented over here. And once there is that kind of a commitment, so Russia and Iran will be playing a different game. Because right now, as you saw, I mean, Steve was mentioning that they're going to up the ante if the U.S. or outside powers are going to support the rebels. But regardless of this, so whether the West is supporting or not, in fact, it hasn't been supporting in any substantive way, Russians, even just before Geneva was about to start, they sent a massive shipment of weapons to the Syrian regime. So they are upping the game because they know they are winning. That's the because they know the West is not acting, and they know they have the upper hand.
So see, take a deep breath, Idris. I want to know if you're changing Steve Walt's mind.
Okay, yeah, no, sure.
No, I mean, I don't think the label we put on it is particularly critical. It's obviously not an even fight. It is it's a one-sided fight, although there were periods where it looked like the Assad regime was actually in more trouble. I think that, yes, air power can accomplish some things. It just can't tip the balance in any particularly decisive way.
Could it not stop the barrel bombing?
It might, but that's not the thing that's winning the war for him. You know, just a few days ago, there was a raid that was entirely a ground force attack that killed a number of rebels as well. So, you know, the idea that there is a quick magic bullet that we declare a no-fly zone and that leads Assad to fold his tent and stop doing what he's doing, it means he'll adjust his tactics in various ways. I think it's important for everyone to understand that Assad does not have a lot of options here other than winning. I say that not as a defender of the Assad regime, but I think the Alawites behind him and his regime itself understand that loss here is death, and possibly then very extensive retributions against them. So the idea that they're going to say, oh, here comes some American F-15s, I guess it's time to fold our tents is, I think, naive. So if you start down that road, you better be willing to go all the way down that road. And if a few airstrikes or cruise missiles doesn't turn the balance, then are you willing to do more? Are you willing to keep it up for weeks or months? And if we're not willing to do that, then that's not a road we should start down. And by the way, people will be dying throughout that period.
Steve Walt, you heard Larry Ronan say it's the worst humanitarian disaster of his generation. What weight does that carry? And I wonder if you want to argue the point too, Idris.
Steve, well, I'll say first that I think there are many other humanitarian disasters, and I don't think we want to get into the sort of comparative, you know, was Rwanda worse than what has happened in Syria? Was Pol Pot's regime...
Is the Congo worse today?
Exactly. You know, 4 to 6 million people dead in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and we didn't get exercised or overly exercised about that. It's clearly a humanitarian disaster, and it's the kind of thing that does make us want to try and do something. Again, the point I've been making all along is I don't think the United States has vital strategic interests there. It's strictly a humanitarian issue. And we don't have military options that are going to end the humanitarian suffering.
Idris, in London.
I would agree with that. That we don't need to get into the question of ranking, you know, humanitarian disasters. I would say that what's happening there is bad enough, and it is, as Stephen Hawking said, that it's what's happening is an abomination, and it's one that the world is watching coldly from a distance. He said, whereas our emotional intelligence, our sense of collective justice, I think those are fair questions. The question is that, for example, if we started ranking, then we probably will not be paying any attention to Israel-Palestine because on the scale of things, what happens over there is, you know, not as large compared to other disasters, but we recognize the nature or the inherent nature of what the moral outrage over there is, the injustice. But again, what I disagree with Steve again is on the capacity. I don't think that what... people like me and others who have, who are reluctantly asking for some kind of an intervention, it's actually mainly we are responding to the Syrians' call, is because it's not for somebody to come and tip the balance. We have to first of all recognize that this was an indigenous fight. I mean, this is very different from Afghanistan, from Iraq or other places. This is closer to Libya, yes, but again, I think that the lessons of Libya were different. Libya could have ended up as Syria. Yes, it's a mess, but it's not Syria. So I think that what happened over there, I mean, it had 75% of the people's approval at the time. And what happened over there, obviously they're building a state from the ground up. So yes, it could have been much worse. What happened over there is a mess. But in terms of what can tip the balance, I mean, that is obviously not for external powers to do that. But diplomacy, for diplomacy to succeed, there needs to be a sufficient commitment. There needs to be leverage. Right now, the leverage is lacking. So that's why in Geneva and other places, the regime and its backers can use diplomacy as a temporizing measure. They use it to buy time. Meanwhile, the barrel bombs keep dropping, the cluster munitions keep being used, and there's no leverage. The opposition has nothing. So that's why, as long as there's some kind of commitment, I mean, we know from just recent experience, in September, when there was briefly the threat of American intervention, the regime and Russia immediately responded. So for that reason, I do think that there needs to be something behind the diplomacy.
What did you learn from that threat in August after the sarin gas? Steve Walt.
I think that you saw that Russians did get involved militarily. They, of course, or not militarily, rather diplomatically, and of course bailed us out when we had walked ourselves out on this particular ledge. You'll recall it began with us moving towards some sort of military force. Then Obama backed away at one point and said, well, he was going to go to Congress. By the way, he was widely criticized for that, but I'll just say as a footnote, it's a really radical idea that you would seek congressional approval for the use of military force here in a democracy. That's, I think, how the way the government is supposed to run.
That was perhaps the best part of it.
But in any event, back to this. And then, of course, that he was widely criticized for. And after John Kerry either deliberately or inadvertently made a statement about, well, maybe if he gave up his chemical weapons. The Russians swooped in. And, of course, they did this because this bolstered the Assad regime. Suddenly, we had to do business with Assad. And their principal goal is to preserve him in power in at least part of Syria. So they were willing to support this, I think, not because they thought we were about to use it. By the time that deal was struck, we were taking the threat of force off the table. It was pretty clear Obama was not going to get support from Congress and therefore was not going to be able to do it, at which point the Russians seized an opportunity to essentially put Assad back in business as an actor that we had to do business with. And by the way, I just add, from a strategic point of view, one of our main goals should be, in fact, to pursue the disarming of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal, which we require some cooperation with Assad in order to pull that off, because the last thing we want is for those things to fall into the hands of someone who might use it someplace we don't want.
Speaking of doing business with people, let's not forget the good news that did come out of August and September is the engagement with Iran and a new government there. I mean, from my standpoint, I think all of us would agree, if, Steve Walt, the big objective here is constructive engagement with Iran, what would the United States be doing? Remembering also that, of course, Iran is a key backer of Assad, but also a much bigger, more important, richer, more interesting possibility.
I think that the United States has a very powerful interest in exploring whether or not it can have a different relationship with Iran for all the reasons you just said. Potentially powerful country. We have a very bad relationship with us, which screws up lots of our other dealings with countries in the region. And they have a nuclear research program that we would like to cap or contain and limit as much as we possibly can. It's very much in our interest to see if we can get a deal. We don't know yet if we can get a deal. And we don't know whether or not getting, say, progress on the nuclear deal would then lead to a somewhat more cooperative relationship. There are a variety of reasons why Iran has backed the Assad regime so heavily. What I keep hoping for is that if we can get to a better place with Iran, not warm friendship, but a more constructive relationship, then they start to have some more incentives to collaborate with us on issues like Syria and Afghanistan and Gulf security more generally. In a sense, they start to have something to lose if we have a more constructive relationship with them. Certainly, for the United States to escalate in Syria now, and again, in my view, to no good humanitarian purpose, unfortunately, would put more strain on the nuclear talks, which I think are more important.
Idris, what's the value of a better relation with Iran? What's the risk of screwing it all up?
Well, I think I agree with what Steve just said. I think what has happened is that the U.S., one of the reasons why it hasn't engaged much in or got involved much in Syria is, one, It doesn't want to empower any forces that might turn the guns on Israel. And second, because these negotiations were happening at the back, so it didn't want to do anything which is in any way going to jeopardize what Obama considers as a big achievement. But I think the engagement is constructive, that it's giving Iran something to lose. So until now, the U.S. had no leverage over Iran. But now, if there are commercial ties and if there are any kind of a thaw in relations, so that's going to create a constituency inside Iran as well. It's going to empower the moderates and the ones who are more who have a you can say that who have a more conciliatory approach and who will be more amenable to ditching Assad. Because by now, even in Iran, there is a realization that the guy is a liability to them too. And Assad only has two allies. So I think if one of them is taken out of the equation, even the Russians will be led to reconsider. And but overall, I think that it is a positive thing that there is it's happening. But that doesn't address the immediate, very urgent humanitarian situation. 800,000 people are under siege in Syria, and we have 9.3 million people who are in need of aid. So we have people who are being daily killed. Even when Geneva was happening, so every day the score I would say for Syria was that for the regime was that it was killing more than 200 people every day. That's a situation that requires urgent attention. I mean, we are talking about these long-term solutions, but something is called for in the interim.
Idris, stand by. Mohammed Al-Abdallah is calling on Skype from Washington, D.C. He's a human rights activist, born in Syria, now living in the U.S. He's the executive director of Syria Justice and Accountability Center at The Hague. He also speaks for the same group in Washington. Mohammed and his father and his brother have spent time as political prisoners in Syria. Mohammed, you've stood tall against the regime in Damascus. Hold us to a high standard of universal human rights here. What should we be doing?
Thanks for letting me contributing here. I think the main issue is just Idris made it very clear that there's people dying every day, and this is not acceptable in the 2014. It's never been acceptable, but a big thing about the Syrian conflict is that it's been one of the most and the best documented conflicts in the world. That means that we see the pictures of the and the videos of the people being killed every day, the videos of the barrel bombs just dropped at the head of the people, and we see all these reports coming from, for example, the UN 3 days ago were discussing the Security Council a resolution for allowing the access of the aid and the humanitarian aid and the medical aid. Everybody described the barrel bombs. Everybody described the Scud missiles. Everybody talked about the chemical weapons, but nobody doing anything to stop these actions, to stop Assad from killing people, from besieging cities, from starving prisoners to death, from torturing them to death. We've seen horrifying images during the week of Geneva talks where 11,000 prisoners were starved to death and they tortured to death and they're dropped in mass graves. And nobody doing this because the UN is not doing anything. The UN
hold it right there, Mohammed. I want to get Steve Walt's reaction. Has tyranny ever been so accessible to media in a certain way and so inaccessible to power?
I think we've had other cases where, you know, what people used to call the CNN effect played a role. Mm-hmm. If you saw something horrific happening, that would trigger the natural human instinct to want to try and do something about it. But I think if you look at the record of American foreign policy, by and large, the United States has not intervened for purely humanitarian purposes with military force unless there were strategic interests involved. And that's in part because it's a very complicated task, and one often can make things worse by getting involved even when you do so with the best of intentions.
Mohammed Al-Abdallah, what is your idea of an effective intervention here?
Here's my comment and Steve's just he said about the CNN impact. That's happened in Bosnia, Srebrenica. We saw a massacre, we saw a mass grave. The Dutch government has to quit all of it, the entire cabinet, because the Dutch military was in charge of securing the Bosnians and the massacre occurred there. And unfortunately, we've seen about a Srebrenica in Syria in the scale of 2014, the chemical attack on civilians, killing 1,400 civilians, children, women, in 10 minutes.
We're talking about an American dilemma around Syria. We're talking more broadly about our post-Iraq, post-Cold War American role in the world. Conversation with Steve Walt of Harvard, the arch realist, and Mohammed Idris Ahmad in London. Nabi Boulos joins us. He's a violinist. He was in Damascus and Homs in Syria 2 weeks ago. He's the concertmaster of the Palestinian National Orchestra, associate concertmaster of Daniel Barenboim's beloved West East Divan Orchestra. He's also a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and others. Nabi Boulos, what were you looking for in Damascus and what did you find?
Well, we were there basically to cover the humanitarian aspect of what was going on in the immediate aftermath of these local ceasefires that had been forged. And the main sensation I got was that people were just exhausted. After about 3 years of war, people really had just had enough. And the fervor that you had seen in the beginning of this revolution, or whatever you want to call it, is largely gone. People are just tired and want this to end.
Does that mean giving up?
I mean, possibly. The government has been calling these movements reconciliation, and there's been a large move to have these in places like Berze, places like Ma'adlamiyeh. These are neighborhoods around Damascus that have a Sunni majority. Now, of course, others have called them capitulations, and that may be the case. One can make that argument. The point remains, people are just tired, and it's been happening largely in neighborhoods that are besieged by the government forces, so no food is coming in, no aid is coming in. So people, yes, have surrendered at some level. But also, it's recognition of the fact that this is not ending anytime soon, and it needs to end in some way.
We're talking about American interventions of various kinds. What would your expectation be, your hope, your fear, where American power is concerned?
Well, I have to tell you, I can't imagine that there would be a good American intervention in that region. I mean, as an Arab and as an American as well, I've managed to see foreign policy from America in the region to have been pretty catastrophic, and I can't see that changing. I agree with Mr. Walt here and what he said with regards to having, or I should say, focusing more on the humanitarian aspect, or maybe even forging a humanitarian corridor so as to do some kind of cross-border exchange of humanitarian aid. That's the extent of it, I would say. I can't imagine firepower helping.
Is it fair for me to ask, you know, do Palestinians have a kind of a tilt toward Assad? As a man who has stood with their cause and they've cut him a lot of slack?
For sure. I mean, of course, you have in the Yarmouk camp where I was actually present when there was aid coming in and people were coming out.
That was where the striking picture in the New York Times and all over the world came today.
Exactly.
It was a shock.
It's a horrific situation, absolutely horrific. I was there actually also a few months ago when you would see the fighting between the different factions of the Palestinian refugees there. And I mean, it's an interesting situation. It's a microcosm of what's going on throughout Syria because you have factions that are pro-Assad and those that are anti-Assad. Now, of course, Palestinians in Syria have had it better off than most other countries, frankly, in the region. The Yarmouk camp, for example, was a place where you had, I think, the largest refugee population among the Palestinians, and they had enjoyed some rights that were denied them in other places. So, yes, I can see that happening in terms of Palestinians giving them slack. At the same time, you also have factions within the camp itself that were actually, and that remain to be, in fact, virulently anti-Assad.
Steve, are we ready to accept a kind of effective surrender to the Assad regime?
I think that certainly that's going to be one of the things we have to start getting ourselves accustomed to, the idea that and this is hard to say because for all the obvious reasons, but that what may be best for the Syrian people in terms of ending human suffering is to say, all right, we're not going to drive him from power. The rebels are not going to be able to do that. We are not going to turn Syria into a 5-year bloodletting for the purpose of removing this guy, even though we think what he has done is reprehensible, undoubtedly constitutes war crimes, etc. But that ultimately, what you want is fewer people dying, you might have to acknowledge that he's going to remain in power with perhaps a rump Syria, only portions of it, you know, Damascus and an arc sort of to the coastline, and that other parts are going to be run by other groups, and then we're going to have to start trying to figure out how we deal with them. I think that's at least a possibility we have to sort of begin to reconcile ourselves to.
Steve Wall, I want us to hatch a new foreign policy by the end of this hour. Two questions to get you started. How do we come in a humanitarian emergency like this to be so deficient in appropriate tools? I mean, we've got the power to blow the world up many times. We still have a kind of Cold War Pentagon, but we seem so irrelevant and helpless in a real situation here.
Well, it's primarily because military power is a very crude instrument. It's hard to do fine-tuning, and it's hard to do social engineering with it. The second reason is, of course, we don't have unilateral capabilities, particularly when you're dealing with local political conflicts, conflicts of identity, conflicts that are occurring in small spaces, as it were. The United States is still extraordinarily powerful. We can still deter most conventional conflicts from happening. We can reverse large-scale conventional aggression, as we did when we threw Iraq out of Kuwait. We've got lots of things we can do with military force. What we're not very good at, and we've seen this in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and elsewhere, we're not very good at social engineering, particularly in parts of the world where we're not very popular and where we don't understand the fine-grained nature of the social, ethnic, religious relations there. Hmm. That's something that the 82nd Airborne or a drone doesn't do for you.
Here's the second part of my question. From the days of George W. Bush's crusading adventure and maybe delusions, and including the scandalized hindsight on what we wrought in Iraq, including also the Obama illusions about what war in Afghanistan could do, and also the dashed hopes around the Arab Spring, do we even want to measure the lost altitude in American confidence and in our own sense of our usefulness in the world?
Well, I think, for example, the claim that the United States is becoming isolationist is preposterous. We're still militarily engaged all over the world. We still have the world's most capable military. We have economic ties all over. We're going to maintain all of those. And we're diplomatically very active on a number of fronts, and I hope to good purpose. What we may be doing, however, and I hope this is the case, is reverting to what George W. Bush promised us when he ran for president but did not deliver.
Humility.
A humble foreign policy. Again, that's not a policy of sitting home and doing nothing. It's a policy that recognizes what American power can and cannot accomplish and doesn't try to run the politics in every corner of the world, trusts people in other places, trusts our partners and friends in other parts of the world to do some of that for us, not just because that relieves us of the burden, but also because in some cases they care more about the outcome and they may even do a better job.
Mohammed Idris Ahmad in London, what do we need to get there? Give us a new policy.
Well, I think if I can just respond to a few of the things Steve said, I would just say that in terms of action, I mean, clearly there was skepticism when Bosnia was happening as well in the realist camp, but obviously it worked. And I mean, I would, in fact, encourage every realist to meet at least one Bosnian and find out, I mean, if they can find any Bosnian who was unhappy that the U.S. intervened at the time. And secondly, what I would say that Steve used the word social engineering a couple of times. I mean, which would be the case if we are talking about Iraq. But in Syria, it doesn't apply because there was an indigenous uprising. And so it's not the U.S. which is going there and deciding the outcome. If Assad hasn't been overthrown, it's just because he has the overwhelming sort of supremacy of force. And that is the only thing that is keeping him there. And his backers are more committed to his preservation than the opposition has been. So for that reason, I think that the situation hasn't been resolved. And as regards the situation, I think that initially I was very skeptical of things like responsibility to protect, but I now recognize that how important it is to move away from some of the notions which, for example, if we just take the concept of sovereignty, we need to rethink it. We'll take a place like Pakistan, where when you have a drone attack, we immediately recognize that that's a breach of sovereignty in Pakistan. And one of the reasons is because it's overwhelmingly opposed by people over there, the drone attacks. But in Syria, we use sovereignty as a sort of a shield for inaction. We use it as a cover for inaction. Whereas inside Syria, we have all these people demanding that the U.S. do something. And yet, I mean, we are only taking the state as somehow the guarantor or the guardian of that sovereignty, even the state's when the state's legitimacy itself is in question. So I think that we need to reconsider sovereignty. It should issue from the people rather than from governments. And so I think that the responsibility to protect does take that into account. And it's just that there are no enforcement mechanisms. And that's why international law is quite inadequate at the moment, because you know, a lot of people, when they keep mentioning that how any action in Syria is going to be illegal, right now legality has been reduced to, you know, whether does Putin agree? Because, you know, that's what stands between what might be considered legal and illegal. If that is all, so then maybe we should give precedence to morality rather than legality of an action. And I think that this, at this stage, there needs to be a mechanism. There needs to be a body's. The world needs to reconsider. I think that the world cannot be held hostage by the Putins of the world. And
Steve Wall, I wonder what you observe about the effective actual changes in American policy under President Obama, announced or unannounced. What are we learning about this president most of the way through his term now?
I think this is a little bit of a crude comparison, but in a sense, I think we have a reversion back to the approach that you might characterize as the Clinton administration, or very similar to the Clinton administration, where the United States engages, worries about a number of problems, is active diplomatically, but is very leery of committing large amounts of military force. Bill Clinton did not want to do Bosnia. I don't think Bosnia is a particularly good comparison here for a variety of reasons, among other things, much smaller space, much more manageable problem, far fewer people involved than would be involved in Syria. And there's not nearly as many different now groups and other powers getting involved. But Clinton was actually pretty leery of doing this, refused to contemplate ground troops in the Kosovo War in 1999 as well. That was done, you know, sort of entirely from the air as well. And I think we see something similar with Obama as well, that he is engaged. He's willing to use drones against suspected terrorists. He's willing to use special forces in very large numbers. But he's not willing to do large commitments of ground troops. And I think, for example, he regrets the decision to have escalated in Afghanistan, because that doesn't seem to have worked out particularly well. What we're going back, therefore, is to a not disengagement, but a greater skepticism for what military force and, in particular, large amounts of American ground troops can accomplish. I think you even see that in the budget decisions that were announced earlier this week. We're not going to have a big army because we're not fighting big ground wars.
This sounds a lot like Fred Kaplan's line in Slate magazine, and it's intriguing. I mean, that this president is not disengaged at all. He's just against war. He's talking to Iran. He recognizes a new global diffusion of power better than some of his predecessors did. I mean, do we believe that?
I think we do. And I think what Obama understands is that the United States is an extraordinarily secure country, that we are protected still by two oceans. We are far more powerful than anyone else. We have a large, wealthy, diverse economy, and that therefore the safety of Americans, the lives of Americans, and their prosperity is not affected very much by what's happening in various parts of the world. And therefore, we may occasionally use our power for humanitarian reasons, but we have to be very careful not to get sucked into things that then do start to endanger the lives of Americans or do start to endanger our prosperity. And I agree with what Idris said about, you know, responsibility to protect, but one of the criteria for applying that doctrine of intervening is that you have a prescription that you really are confident will work. And that's, again, where he and I disagree. I don't think his prescription will work, and he thinks it does.
We're talking about American dilemmas around Syria. Imad is calling from Boston.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I wonder what your guests, and especially Mr. Stephen Walt, think about the whole talk about intervention seems to ignore that our own close allies, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, who are anti-democratic to the core, are actually intervening, have been intervening in Syria as our own proxies, financing, training, providing military support, and sending takfiris, which put us effectively on the side of al-Qaeda, who are committing also atrocities, as much as the Syrian army is committing atrocities.
Might I take your question? Is the tail wagging the dog here, or are our friends getting us into trouble? Steve Walt.
Well, I think that's one of the things that gave the Obama administration some pause back last fall. They began to realize that as bad as things were, they could, in fact, get worse if we ended up empowering a bunch of groups that were really, really quite nasty. I think there has been some effort in recent weeks to try and coordinate better with Saudi Arabia in particular as to who they're providing support to. Saudis announced, I think, a couple of days ago that they were actually putting limits on the ability of Saudi citizens to travel to Syria to fight as well. Whether they actually do that remains to be seen. But I think there is a growing awareness of the concern that the caller just alluded to, that you don't want to be pouring gasoline in a way that the fire might actually come back to your own home.
Nabi Boulos, your turn.
Also, I should add that Jordan's role is a bit more unclear because Jordan has had a almost a reluctant attitude towards training and arming some of these rebels coming through. And in fact, Jordan, you know, I've been told, has had some form of intelligence sharing with the Syrian government with regards to jihadis going across its borders. So it's not a clear-cut matter with Jordan in that sense.
Idris, in London, I wonder what your take on President Obama personally is. And related to it, reports we hear that, you know, he has asked his advisors to go back to the drawing board around Syria. He's thinking of other options, including cyber war, conceivably a re-escalation of the sort that would please you. What do you make of his leadership?
If I can briefly just respond to the previous question, I think the issue with Saudi involvement is that Saudi involvement didn't begin, the weapons shipments didn't begin until the end of 2012. The war has been going on since March of 2011. So I think that that's a red herring. Now, regarding the question that you, Obama's rather Obama's role, I think in terms of what he has achieved in recent years, especially this opening with Iran, that's a big achievement. I mean, if just a few years back we were talking about the possibility of war with Iran, and now that's completely off the table, and I think that's a big achievement. But on the other hand, obviously, what has happened with the drone war and this kind of a war without borders, whether it's in Pakistan, in Yemen, or in Somalia, I think that's a very dangerous precedent that he's leaving behind, and also a lot of the these extrajudicial killings. I mean, that's a precedent which, even if you go back to 2001, people like Martin Indyk were giving statements when Israel were carrying out similar assassinations at how against American norms they were.
And Idris, we're going to leave it there and take our gains in Iran relations most especially. Steve Walt, thank you. Mohammed Idris Ahmad, thank you. And Nabi Boulos, thank you, too. Thanks also to Larry Ronan and the Physicians for Human Rights in Boston. There's more on our website, including an interview with a Syrian architect and historian who tells a very touching story of the life and death of his country through the story of his father. Next week, we're talking about Black Power, the slogan of 50 years ago and the realities of today. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Kunal Jasti, and George Hicks at the Radio Controls. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.